Welcome to Vault 33, a podcast for Amazon Prime's Fallout. We are your hosts, Andrew Sorsini,
Dwayne D,
and Tosin Unifowaken.
We just watched the second episode of Fallout, entitled The Target. We assume you have as well. Total spoilers ahead. Let's dive into the after talk, but before we do, remember to follow us on Twitter at FalloutVault33, add us on iTunes, Spotify, and all the other streaming services. Like us, please leave us a review, that's how we get noticed. But the best thing you can do, of course, is spread the word, tell your friends. We want to get everyone that you know to like us the way that you like us. This episode was written by Genevieve Robertson-Dworet and Graham Wagner, and once again directed by Jonathan Nolan. This is the second episode that has that creative team up, and actually even the third episode coming up will have that same team up. Dwayne, why don't you give us a recap of this episode?
You got it. Okay, so we open with a breeding or a kennel, at a kennel laboratory, something. There's newborn puppies that are weighed, and those don't meet 10 ounces are immediately thrown into an incinerator. Dr. Siggy Wilsig is one of the scientists in the puppy lab and lies about a newborn puppy girl that doesn't meet the weight threshold before it can be thrown into the incinerator. He saves her life and labels her with a branding device that says CX-404. CX-404 is raised with the other puppies for a time. The puppies are given injections from large needles, but before that can happen to CX-404, Dr. Wilsig spirits her away from the training program into his personal quarters where he raises and trains a dog, hiding it behind a false wall when necessary. Meanwhile, Wilsig is working on a personal project in his quarters that involve preparing some glowing filament that he then injects into his own neck. One day he's caught as a colleague scientist comes across CX-404 in his personal lab, and he flees with the dog. Wilsig is the bounty that the Brotherhood of Steel are chasing. We also meet Lucy on a beach. She's exploring the ruins of a seaside community. She's pleased at the setting, but disturbed at the rusting ruins she encounters, as well as whole families dead and rotting as they sit around their dinner table. They've taken poison in the bottle that was still on the table. It was a product of the Vault-Tec company. When night falls, Lucy makes a fire in the open and she falls asleep. She's woken up by the dog CX-404 sniffing her. The dog immediately lunges behind her and kills a giant cockroach the size of a cat. Wilsig is there sitting on a chair creepily, and he recognizes her as a vault dweller and gives her some advice before moving on. Wilsig and CX-404 find their way to a cave in the middle of the woods where they rest. There are warnings around the cave, and CX-404 finds the bones of the dead. The next morning, we see Nyctitus' transport aircraft traversing the waste, and sometime later, Maximus and Nyctitus show up at the entrance of the same cave that Wilsig was at. Sharp-eyed Maximus recognizes that Wilsig and the dog were likely there recently, but Titus worries that they were taken by whatever giant beast lives inside the cave. Nyctitus sends Maximus into the cave and follows. Nyctitus is attacked by a giant irradiated bear and suffers pretty bad wounds. Titus blames Maximus for the fiasco, and when he does, Maximus decides that Titus isn't living up to his duty as a knight. Rather than help Titus, Maximus lets the knight die from his wounds in his armor. After killing the beast, Maximus takes the armor and the persona of Nyctitus. Maximus heads to Philly in Nyctitus' armor. He comes across two people fighting about chickens, and he stops one of them, only to find out that the one he actually hurt was trying to stop the other man from sexually abusing his hens. Lucy finds her way to Philly, where she happens on Majun's sundry store, a place that sells Vault-Tec and other curiosities. It also happens to be the place where Wilsig is headed to make contact with whomever can save him from the bounty hunters who are after him. Lucy encounters both Wilsig there, but also Cooper the ghoul. Lucy tries to stop Cooper from capturing Wilsig, but she's outmatched. Maximus arrives in time in Titus's armor to temporarily stop Cooper, since Maximus is after Wilsig himself. As they fight, Wilsig is injured, but he escapes the fray with Lucy, and Lucy and them join together to head to see Muldaver, the very woman whose gang killed so many in Vault 33 and who kidnapped Lucy's father. In the confusion, CX-404 is left behind. Cooper the ghoul disables Maximus's armor, and as Maximus deals with that, Cooper finds the dog CX-404 and uses her to continue after Lucy and Wilsig. Wilsig and Lucy escape out of Philly into the wasteland toward the Moldover hideout. When they're 20 miles away, Wilsig realizes he's not going to be able to make it. His injuries are too debilitating. He lets Lucy know that he's taken the same poison that killed the family Lucy walked by and will die soon. She shouldn't worry, though, because what she needs to get her father back is in his head, literally. He gives her a bone saw and says she should cut it off and continue toward Moldaver. Not only because his head can be bargained with Moldaver to secure the release of her father, but also because whatever secrets he's been injecting inside of his head can, quote, change the future. Then he dies of poison, and then Lucy cuts off his head and continues on her journey. So, you know, it's grisly, but it works. Guys, that leg thing, oh my God. Like, that leg thing, when, like, he just loses his leg randomly, and then as quickly as anything, they just shove, like, a false leg thing on his leg, and you're like, it's almost like, you know, in Star Wars, when, like, Darth Vader gets all burned up, and they don't even seem to wash him, they just put on the suit. You know,
right.
You're like, wait a minute, that doesn't seem sanitary. That's exactly what happened with this. And you're like, oh, okay, I guess that's how it works. And then when they're by the Russian satellite, and he's like, I'm done. You realize that it didn't really work. Like, there's blood everywhere. He's lost quarts of blood. Yeah. He's really not going to make it. And it's just like this. Like, I mean, they're trying to show us how the world is crazy grisly compared to the sanctity of the vault, like the safety of the vault. But I gotta say, like, I'm still constantly surprised at how grisly the world is. And it's not like a dirty, dark brown grisly like what you get in The Last of Us. It's like a full color, bright, happy, and then suddenly grisly situation. So I'm always thrown off. And even with the leg situation, I'm left thinking it's comical. Like, it was comical that he had, like, this duck waddle leg thing on, even though
wasn't even set right. It was, like, at a weird angle.
Yeah, I mean, everything about it was so bizarre, but also so perfect for the weirdness that is Fallout.
What was your general opinion about this episode, Dwayne?
I liked it. I liked how, so in the first episode, we meet these four different, you know, sort of like plot lines, right? There's the Lucy situation, the Maximus Brotherhood of Steel situation. There's Cooper the Ghoul. There's Cooper the Not Ghoul, pre-ghoul. Mm-hmm. And then now, and this time we meet Wilzig. And Wilzig brings them all together, right?
Right.
He's a MacGuffin. He brings them all together. And so they intersect in this moment, but then they outersect almost as quickly, right? This is the episode where if you've been watching YouTube and they showed like a scene from the show, it was like the sort of a... set piece of this episode was this sort of little three-way Mexican standoff battle between these different factions. And I definitely enjoyed that. I also enjoyed how, you know, the armor seems impenetrable, but a clever ghoul manages to disable it. And also, it's pretty clear that Maximus doesn't quite know what he's doing, and that's what makes Maximus a cool character. So I did enjoy this episode a lot because we got to know the characters when they were in kind of stress mode.
Yeah.
Right. They weren't just like walking around, hey, this is me. They had to like perform, and they don't always make the best choices. And I think that's great.
Tosin, how about you? What were your general thoughts about this episode?
Yeah, I generally did also enjoy this episode. I think within this episode, we got a closer look at Lucy as well as Maximus and their sort of idealized worldview. Shifted and changed, and so that was really interesting to see that see that adaptation and kind of go through their journey and go through how they change, but also how they remain the same in many areas. So yeah, I thought it was a solid episode. What about yourself, Andy?
This one, I thought like laid a lot of like important pipe. And I don't think I don't think it was as intriguing to me as the first episode, but I think it was necessary. And I think
Lucy had some pipe laid in that first episode too.
But I think yes. But I think the important the best thing that I brought out of this episode is that by the end of the episode, all of the motivations are clear. Like, Wilzig needs to get to Moldaver, Lucy needs to bargain with Moldaver, and so has to bring whatever Wilzig has in his head to Moldaver. Maximus needs to protect that valuable asset, which is Wilzig. The ghoul needs Wilzig before he gets to Moldaver. So you have everybody by the end of this episode, it feels to me like the motivations for the rest of the season are laid out. Like, we all know where everyone's path is moving forward. So that to me...
Gotcha. Do you know who the ghoul is supposed to deliver the head to?
I don't know, but I do know that he has to get the head before Moldaver gets it.
Okay, because it'd be funny if he ended up having to get it to Moldaver too. It's the question of who gets awkward. The attribution, right?
Right. But yeah. In general, I like this episode. It just didn't hold for me the same overall appeal as the first episode, which was doing a lot. That episode was doing a lot of heavy lifting. Really set the tone. So before we talk about like the individual points, intriguing points about this episode, the salient points, let me just deliver another note about our analysis, our approach to this. Once again, all the episodes are currently available, but we're only going to be discussing what we learned in this particular episode 102, The Target. And we will be referring also to the first episode 101.
We go backwards, we don't skip forwards.
Yes, we won't.
That's kind of why we have the whole recap in the front, so we know where we're supposed to stop.
Right. We're not going to be discussing plot points ahead of this episode, or if we do, it'll be from speculation. We won't be doing it because we've watched ahead. All right, so let's talk about some of the salient points that I pulled out of this episode. I thought it was interesting that CX-404 was given that moniker, because 404 in HTTP error codes means file not found, and CX-404 specifically was not supposed to exist. He was supposed to be tossed out with the rest of she was supposed to be tossed out with the rest of the underfed puppies, and so CX-404 is a perfect moniker for that.
Can we also talk about how, you know, how much planning it takes to like notch out a huge cavern behind your brick wall in order to like make a bed for a German
That's some Shawshank Redemption stuff right there.
I know. I mean, or like Escape from Alcatraz. Like, he's just like, okay, you did that. All right, dude. Because he's kind of a white collar guy. Wilson, yeah. Right. So, you know, he doesn't really seem like the kind of tough guy. Like when he has to get out of there, it wasn't because he had like a super plan to get out of there. The dog happened to just straight up kill the colleague. And he's like, well, between the alarm going and the fact that I can't fake that he died falling somewhere because there's blood everywhere because my dog ripped him apart, I kind of got to go. It didn't strike me as, you know, the kind of guy who's going to find a way to break a hole in the wall and build that bed for the baby.
I think all of that goes to sort of build the aspect of Dr. Wilzig's character, that he's got this spark of compassion. Like, he deliberately tipped the scale to save CX-404 from the incinerator. He's
literally, yeah,
hiding her in a hole in the wall. Like, it feels like to me, like, he realizes, he understands the reality of the world and how harsh it is. And so he's trying to literally carve out a little compassion out of that world.
See, I don't know if that's the case, because, you know, why would you choose 404 over any other dog, right? Like, we see one get thrown in and he's doing the scale tipping. I mean, he's doing the measurements on the scale. He could have chosen any dog, but yeah, he chose her for some reason. And it's almost as if he needed her for a job, like a thing. Like, it all seems so planned between the back area where he's keeping the dog. And it almost seems as if he's got some... And, you know, he's obviously developing whatever he's developing that he shoves into his own kind of like neck gland area. So I wonder if it was all like a big grand design that just kind of
interesting
didn't work out, because he could have saved any dog, but he chose 404. And then he had 404, you know, in the program up until they were about to inject her with whatever that was that they were injecting into the dogs. I guess, you know, in the beginning of a dog's life, it needs to, like, I guess, nurse or whatever. It was just very interesting to me that everything seemed so planned until he got caught And part of the reason he got caught was he was tired, right? So he's sleeping, he's laying down, the dog's licking his face, and he's like, oh, I gotta get up, I gotta get up. And so he wasn't on whatever schedule or timeline, which is why he was happened upon by his colleague. And then when his colleague like knocked him down, that's when the dog's like, you know, I'm gonna kill you.
Exactly.
Because that's what these kinds of dogs do. So
well, you know, usually 404 errors, you know, at least for me, you may encounter them after going to resources that typically work, and they certainly stop. So, you know, maybe it's literally just a change in how he feels or perceives the world. You know, maybe his maybe as an individual, he has grown and changed in his own way and had his own, you know, type of journey that we see along the ways where he's, you know, warning Lucy and you know, not, you know, taking her stuff, but giving her tips to kind of stay alive and giving her, you know, telling her, hey, this world is not for you. And I also just generally think not
I can
all
agree
the
with that. Yeah.
Not all the characters that we see fit in sort of the idealized bubble. Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the, Maximus who, or I guess the original guy who played Lord Titus, where we are seen to believe them as like a paladin of like greater strength and fortitude, is actually
and like moral fortitude,
like
right?
A like high moral compass, right?
Yeah, like a person with just like high motivations and like high and mighty ideals,
right? Is really just a scared individual, a bumbling scared individual. We find, you know, the doctor here doesn't always follow the rules or play by the same constraints that everyone else is supposed to do. And then, you know, Lucy is what I consider an adventurer. We talked about in the first episode how she kind of had that sort of second thought in one of the scenes prior to getting wedded. And so I feel like even without this quest for her father, she still would have become on the same path. And then finally, like Maximus, we heard that, hey, Maximus wouldn't hurt a fly, right? He's this simple guy, but ultimately he lets the original Titus die. So I think we see that all the characters add some additional level of complexity.
Yeah, there's an archetype and then they break those archetypes.
Yeah, and whether or not they stay with those broken archetypes is to be seen.
Yeah, it's true. Because on some level, it's like, I mean, I won't talk about this at the big picture, but, you know, the surface changes you or, you know, where you're already there kind of thing.
Right.
But yeah, so I definitely got to say when it came to Titus, I think you're perfectly right. He was a super scared dude in his armor. And, you know, with his armor, he's all big and bad. And he's like, I'm bored. I want to shoot something or whatever. Right. Yeah. And then when it comes to the giant bear thing, you know, he was outmatched. And also, it's as a watcher, as a viewer, you see this seemingly impenetrable, you know, set of armor, and you realize that it is vulnerable, which is why he has a squire, right?
Right.
Because
right.
On some level, he needs somebody to support him. Although the squire thing is so funny to me because, like, why are you dragging around this gigantic bag? Right. Like it's super easy for him to lift the bag.
Right.
In fact, when he jumps off of the transport, you know, you have all those clips on your squire outfit so you can be clipped to safely to the knight for that kind of like transit.
Totally.
So like I don't really get why you couldn't like get on the knight's back, you know, holding the bag and he can run to wherever you gotta go. Right. And then, you know, when he engages, then you get off the back and go hide and like shoot from the back and camp or whatever. Camp gamer style, not camp as in like pitch a tent.
Right.
And, you know, help him out that way. But
I mean, yeah, it's a status quo thing.
It was all about the status,
that's what
right?
it is.
It
yeah.
Like, which is why Titus was basically like, they're going to kill you because you didn't protect me. Yeah,
we see that like early on, like when Maximus and Titus are in the airship together, and he basically tells her to clean. He basically tells him to clean my jock. You know, he hands him
his codpiece. He hands him the armor.
He wants,
which is weird because it's like, what is that? It's not. It doesn't seem that dirty. So
no, but he wants to put Maximus in his place. It's part of like a posturing thing. And, you know, him saying you've got to earn the suit through acts of bravery, which clearly we see in the very next scene that that's maybe not the case. Like, I don't know how Titus earned his suit, but he certainly lacked also, bravery.
Yeah, exactly. He totally lacked bravery. But also, like, how does Titus get the suit? Because it seems like these squires are disposable. What's interesting to me also is that the armor is a T-60.
Yeah.
And Luke Skywalker flies a T-65. X-wing. Mm-hmm. So, because when I heard T-60, my brain was like, bing, bing, bing. There's something there. Something there. I don't know. It's just another iconic thing. What I really love visually is how his armor has that mark from the bear on it. And so now, whenever we see more armored people, we'll be able to recognize this suit of armor.
Oh, yeah.
From the other ones.
Oh yeah.
And it looks badass. It's just a very clever, quick move by the art team, the director. Mm-hmm. To differentiate it, like a dwarf with a broken horn on his helmet.
I think it's interesting that after that whole sequence with the bear, and after Titus basically dies, I mean, I think when Titus was lying wounded, and he's like, these clerics with their bullshit sending me on stupid missions, Maximus immediately recognizes that Titus is not a true believer. He isn't indoctrinated the way Maximus has been. He's not a true believer, and he's not particularly brave. And I think that's what the thing that sort of like is the tipping point that makes that lets Titus die, that he lets Titus
die.
I
disagree with that, actually.
Really?
Yeah, because I would say that first of all, I think that when it comes to Titus getting in the suit, he might have been a believer, but after the toaster of it, it seems like he's like, what the fuck is this shit, right? This is not what I signed up for. But more important, I think when he said, they're gonna kill you for this, as in, I'm gonna tell them this is all your fault, because he kept on repeating, this is all your fault, this is all your fault, and it clearly wasn't Maximus's fault. He's a green squire. They go into the cave together. He's like, you go forward, I guess, as bait or like whatever. And then at the end of the day, you know, Maximus actually kills the bear and not Titus. I mean, obviously, Titus is like an involuntary distraction for the bear. But he kills him, and he's going to get the stim pack or whatever. And so he realizes that if he saves this man's life, this man's going to have him recalled and be killed. He's saying everything's your fault when it's not his fault. And he's like, I have no way to defend against this. I'm tired of being beat up on, is how I interpreted that.
Well, I'm
tired of people. So I don't think it was like, it's a toaster oven. And he's like, you think it's just a toaster oven?
No, forget you. That's not what I'm saying. I don't think it's as clear cut as that. I think maybe understanding that he might get snitched on and then lose his position was a factor.
Or his life, yeah.
Or his life was a factor. But I think what really tipped the scale for Maximus was recognizing that Titus was not truly a believer. And because Maximus has been indoctrinated, he has this vision of who these knights are from as a kid. You know, he was saved by a knight, and so he's got this vision of what a chivalrous knight should be, and he says, you don't deserve that armor. He tells Titus, totally. You don't deserve that armor. And so
I agree with that. I just feel like when he's like, I'm gonna have you killed, he was like, you're gonna die.
Yeah. So he feels like he needs to like let Titus die and then become fulfill the ideal that he grew up recognizing that a knight should be.
Yeah, it's actually really interesting that he recognizes sort of this knight as this elevated thing, and as soon as he puts it on, he becomes more of a bumbling individual than before.
It's very Shazam, right? Yeah. It's very like, I'm a kid in this grown-up thing, and I'm going to try to do what I'm, and he's obviously trained in how to use it, right? You can't just get in that and go. But he's not experienced. So, you know, it's easy for, not easy, but you know, the ghoul is able to get one over on him. And, I think that's pretty cool. What's interesting is there's a transferability, right? So he's like, man, you're not the knight that I would be, and therefore I'm going to become this knight.
Right.
And then he becomes this knight, and the minute, I mean, you were going to talk about how the minute Lucy sees him, she's like, oh, a knight, which is, you know,
right,
pretty much
right,
like
right,
her
right.
eyes light up the same way his eyes lit right. up the same way when he saw the first knight when he's a little boy.
Yeah, maybe he's like book trained, but he doesn't have the same sort of experience. And it's also hilarious how, you know, Lucy sees him flying through the sky and like she gives this like wide-eyed smiling look as though he's like a superhero, like
totally, you know, totally
like Superman, when in fact he's still just bumbling and he was just defeated.
Like so. If there were a comic book like caption, it would have been like, ah,
big bold letters that went across a couple of panels.
Exactly.
I'm very curious if the sheen wears off, you know, as we get further mm-hmm. in this for both him as well as for her, right? You know,
Was asked out, right? She was totally, you know, the ghoul was about to take her down. The guy's leg had just been blown off. So her own sense of her own ability was in right. total question.
Right, right.
And then right when the ghoul was going to get everything he wanted, the knight showed up and the knight gave her all the cover she needed to get out of there. And she was like, that knight showed up to help me. There are good people in this world of the wasteland, which is full of terrible people so far, you know? Right. So I think for Lucy, just seeing the knight affirmed her existing biases.
Yeah, I guess that's true. But, you know, when we really look at the people in this world, there's just a lot of complexity, right? So,
oh, there is total cool. complexity. Right. Yeah.
It's nothing cool but complexity.
Completely evil, right? He is.
He's pretty evil, but yeah.
Yeah, but he
also know his little bit of his backstory.
And he heals.
Well,
the dog was
useful to him.
Well, he smiled when he healed the dog. Like he didn't the dog had some use to him, but you could tell that he was still happy that it wasn't completely dead when he
right.
was able to bring it back to life.
Yeah,
and
that's true. That's true.
And then even on like Lucy's part. And you know, maybe this is more bigger picture, but as she's going through this world, one of the first things she experiences is, you know, Vault-Tec allowing people to die, like creating a poison for people to kill
themselves.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second. It's Plan D, which kind of means that the Vault-Tec company, you know, they're planners, right? The Vault-Tec people, yeah. they make vaults that last for 200 years, and those vaults are self-sustained and all that stuff. And here they had, you know, clearly that's Plan A, but doesn't it make you wonder what plans B and C are to get to Plan right. D, right? Like they didn't call it Plan B.
No.
I mean, there's probably like, you know, some political stuff there. But it there's just the idea that like there's plans C and B and C, and then you got to get to D. And you can get it in economy size because it's America.
Right, right.
So you can kill a whole bunch of people. And that is that was definitely sexy. And for her to see that was like, wow, you know. But there's also for Lucy Tosin, you were talking about with Vault-Tec. Mm-hmm. The fact that there's so much Vault-Tec in the store that she comes into.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, wait a minute, where's all this coming from? It can't all have come from like Vault 32, you know, that got busted.
Right.
So you got to wonder what's happening there. And it also makes you wonder what happened to the first 31 volts.
Right,
you
know? Right, right. Like, clearly this detritus came from the other vaults, which must have at some point or another have collapsed or opened up or somehow.
Yeah.
Right, maybe Plan B. And, you know, hopefully that'll be revealed to us over this season, maybe season two. But, yeah, I totally want to know what's going on with these vaults.
As she's kind of going through the real reality of this outside world, throughout the course of the episode, she ultimately gets to this place where she's, like, willing to do what it takes to survive, right? She's willing to take the step of cutting off Dr. Wilczek's head, and we now see finally her loss of innocence in this exterior world, right?
In the first episode
we see her losing it in the interior world, the vault, mm-hmm. with the sort of sex that she had, her I mean, ultimately, it's
the well, she's been having right? sex for a while, but it, I think the loss with of innocence cousin. Had a lot to do with like shoot, yeah, with her cousin. Had to do with like having to like deal out death and destruction while bleeding in her wedding dress,
right? Right,
bare feet, yeah.
And then now, the same sort of loss has happened externally. But of right. course, she's doing this to but, survive.
Like that part of that comes is underscored with the conversation that Dr. Wilsey has with her by the fireplace when he first encounters her. He tells her, "You come from a world of rules and laws. This place is indifferent to all of that. If you insist on staying, you will have to adapt. But the question is, will you still want the same things when you've become a different animal altogether?" And we see that yeah. pay off at the end of this episode with her cutting off Dr. Wilsig's head. She's starting to become, she's starting to adapt. She's starting to learn that this that she's got to do something different than what she was raised to do.
Yeah, and I want to just we just got to hit the part of the big picture now. And I guess when it comes to that, I'm reminded of the first episode where her father was making kind of a speech at the wedding, right?
Yeah.
And he says, "I'll admit, I'm sometimes afraid that mean old world will change us. But then I look at my daughter, and I'm not afraid. I feel hope. Hope, mm. right? Mm. And then, of course, Wilsig says, before she cuts off her head, if you're going to survive, you're going to need to start acting like a surface dweller, Lucy McLean." She's like, "Oh, how do you know my name?" But the idea that, you know, there's a constant push, a constant discussion about how the outside world changes you. And I think it's bigger than Lucy's loss of innocence. I think it has to do with a lot of us, right?
Yeah.
We, you know, Lucy has an ideal of America. And I think growing up, we all have an ideal of who we are as Americans, as individuals, as people in our family, right? Whether you're the big brother or the baby in your family, all that stuff. And then you kind of get into the real world and you have to deal with the fact that basically everybody wants money from you.
Yeah.
And horrible things are happening, and like on some level it's up to you to like vote about which horrible things are going to happen or which aren't, right? So she's dealing with the fact that the world is full of violence and she has to kind of pick her battles, and she picks a battle, the one to like basically help Wilsig in the moment. And she loses that battle, and if it weren't for Maximus, she would have, who knows what would have happened to her. But then also at the end, even when Wilsig said, you know, he's like, "Hey, cut off my head," and she does it, you know, he spoon feeds that to her, right?
Right, right, right.
He
right.
spoon feeds that.
Literally, he spoon feeds it to himself to to kill right. himself so that she can make it easier for her to cut off his head. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, she has this interesting sort of like privilege of people like genuinely kind of liking her
yeah.
because she's this like innocent vault dweller. And on some level, at some point, somewhere, that might wear off. And so we're going to have to see, you know, how she deals with it then. But for the most part, it's like she's being kind of homeopath into this world where she will have to change, and the question is going to be how much of herself can she keep, which is something that Towson kind of brought up a little earlier. But I just wanted to make sure that when it comes to like, that's the same with Maximus, right? Like,
right.
You know, how much she's going to keep. And it's overarchingly the same thing over the last 200 years with Cooper, the man, and Cooper Howard,
right,
and then
right,
Cooper, right, the ghoul, right.
Right? Right?
Like how much of the original Cooper is still in there. And at what point are we going to see him reckon with that past? Like you see some flashbacks of the past, but how is he going to reckon with that? Is he going to come across somebody or something that makes him have to realize, you know, who he's become would be problematic if he mm-hmm, was standing face to face with who he was and the people he used to love. So I feel like that's
yeah. I mean, Lucy means light, right?
Totally. She's the light. She's yeah. so yeah, as a person who's got a kid with a similar name, it's like, you know, you want them to be a beacon in the world. And, you know, she's trying to be, but who knows how long that'll last.
I want to return to some of that in the big picture section, but I just wanted to fire off a couple of other salient points before we finish off this section. Maximus, in his first encounter with the chicken fucker, he defends the wrong person in this conflict. And that's an indication that he still has a lot to learn about the moral indifference of the wasteland.
Yeah, so he understands, you know, his idea of like good versus wrong, but identifying who's good, adjudicating those conflicts is not an easy thing, which explains why most of the people who are out there are living the lives they're living, because they, you know, it's like everyone said, it's more complicated than that. He looks at somebody beating somebody up, he's like, stop, and then he realizes that person's just trying to make sure that his chickens aren't sexually abused,
right?
And that's an early warning for him.
And again, Dr. Wilczek knows exactly who Lucy is by name, so it's very curious. Like, I'm curious about how he knows that, and hopefully, again, that'll be a question that we get answered later on.
It was interesting kind of see this dog who's not really grown up to be a killer, but still has that killer instinct, at least as a protector. And we'll see where the dog goes to now that it's with the ghoul.
Yeah, for me, the things that stuck out were, you know, I loved how the vault outfits, they are evocative of like superhero uniforms.
Oh yeah,
right. I can't help but think of the Fantastic Four every time I see Lucy and the rest of her mates
for sure
in their vault outfits. And speaking of outfits, I've just been like looking at the costumes the second episode, and I love, you know, Maximus asks why Titus chose the tempered lining on his T-60 battle armor, and that's why he's given the codpiece. It's like, he's like, shut up and just clean this.
Exactly.
But in my the way I think about it, I'm sort of like, you know, who knows how many people in the last 200 years have been in this T-60 armor? Did Titus have any choice which suit he got? Did he have any choice about the tempered lining?
Probably right? not.
It's just, you know, that's the kind of thing. So, like, when you think about that in terms of real world versus, like, whatever Maximus has read, you're like, that's kind of a silly question. But, you know, so I just thought that was pretty interesting. Oh, and then finally, I really think that it was interesting to me when I watched the scene over and over again where Wilczek decides to run with the dog, that it seems like the choice to run happened before he was ready to run because he got caught. He had the plan in place if that ever happened. But
right.
When the dog ripped the dude's throat open, as Tosin just said, had that killer instinct.
Right.
Maybe that's why you get rid of the small ones. Maybe the small ones have killer instinct. But it also goes to show that regardless of how small she would have been, she's big enough to get the job done now. So just a reminder that, you know, how it started isn't necessarily how it's going.
All right. We've got some unanswered questions. My big question about this episode is, what is that chip that Dr. Wilczek injects into himself?
What is it a chip?
Well, that's what I read it as, is a chip. It's like, you know, when you chip your dog, it's this tiny little thing that's like the size of a grain of rice, and it's got the information in it. So I read it as a chip, but we'll see. Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I don't know that it's a chip. I don't want people to think I don't want people to assume it's some sort of like chip, especially in a world that's like kind of pre-microchip, right? It's like transistor still. So maybe it is a chip and that's going to change the world. But also, maybe this world seems very chemically dependent, and maybe it's a new sort of serum. I just don't know what it is. I hope it has a very concrete, you know, definition and isn't like something that they're going to try to figure out later, like in an episode of Alias or something. so I hope we can figure out what it actually is. But I don't know what it is. And Tosin, what's your question?
One of the questions I had was just, you know, from a thematic perspective, what's the significance of the doctor dying by like a Soviet satellite of all things? Just any thoughts on from your side?
I feel like maybe it's just a reference that that the Soviet Union was still is. In other words, like in our world, in our reality, the Soviet Union was eventually disbanded and became Russia, essentially. And it feels like maybe in this fictional world, the Soviet Union never fell. It just continued to be a continuous adversary.
Well, until the end of the world.
Until the end of the world. Until everyone
else. So if the end of the world is like some fancy 1960s kind of thing, then the Soviet Union was what was around when the world ended. The fact that it's a Soviet satellite could also mean that, you know, the Soviets were involved in the end of the world. Like, the end of the world situation with the nuclear bombs, you know, we know that back then the U.S. and the Soviets had all the nuclear weapons. So in our reality, you know, with that kind of bias from our reality, we'd know who's dropping those bombs. But in this world, we don't really know who had those bombs, you know, and how it all happened. But the idea that the Russian satellite landed and is relatively intact kind of is like, you know, in L.A., that kind of, you know, tells us that maybe they had an advantage over the U.S. on some level. But I don't think it's directly tied to Wilczek's fate.
Right. I didn't read that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I asked it earlier, but just how many vaults have to fail in order for this Vault-Tec to be out there? And then I think the question everyone's asking is, how does he know her name? And for me, I'm beginning to think that the mystery surrounding her mother might have something to do with it. You know? Yeah, because maybe her mother was a surface dweller that was brought into the vault, somehow got in there. Or maybe she was always a Vault 33-er and she escaped the way Lucy escaped the vault. And I mean, we don't talk about her mom's death explicitly. You know, you hear things like, oh, I wish mom were here or whatever. It could be that she couldn't live in the vault anymore and she left. And I don't know, I'm just extrapolating.
I completely forgot about her mother and that she's like a plot point. Interesting. Okay.
And the thing is, in the first episode,
yeah,
when Moldaver takes, when Moldaver, you know, sees Lucy and her father while they have all those hostages, he's like, you know, I know who you are.
Right.
Which means he's had some contact with the outside world, whether it's through another vault overseer or maybe through Lucy's mother. You know, maybe Lucy Moldaver is taking him to Lucy's mother. I just don't know. But I feel like her mother is going to play a part here. She, like, the scenes of her mother just feel like a Chekhov's gun.
I'm sure you're right. I'm absolutely sure you're right. All right, let's talk about the big picture, some of the big picture ideas in this episode, and that relate to not just this episode, but the entire series. I want to bring up a theme that I sense is emerging in this episode, and I feel like will be emerging through the rest of the series, and that is the idea of idealism versus realism. So Lucy and Maximus are both idealists, and they're both guided by an ethos indoctrinated into them from childhood. Hers is that the Vaulters are here to save America, and his,
to recolonize it too.
Yeah,
recolonize
it, and in doing so, save the nation. Maximus's ideal is, the ideal of the Brotherhood of Steel is to better this fallen world. And so both of them have had those ideals drilled into them from their inception into their respective communities. And both of them find themselves in a wasteland where that idealism doesn't apply at all. And Dr. Wilczek says as much. It's basically like, you know, this, you come from a world of rules and laws. This place is indifferent to all of that. So I feel like we're going to see their journey as coming from a beginning point of idealism and then learning that the real world just does not care.
Yeah. So Maximus is very interesting to me because he comes from this place where they're like, you know, their view is they can save this world or help this dying world, like restore it. And what's interesting to me there is that in his safe space, right, in the Brotherhood of Steel's aspirant barracks, he was getting his ass beat all the time.
Yeah.
Right. He was getting his butt kicked. He, you know, he had a scar on his nose. The first thing his friend says to him is like, how's your nose? Because it looks like it's been broken or something. And it's just that he's just taking a licking. But the world outside is even worse than that. So he's a believer. I mean, and the thing is, he's also, as in this idealist, as much as he's an idealist, he wasn't chosen, you know, in the first round to become a squire.
Right.
And we know kind of why that was. You know, he's sitting in class and he doesn't recognize a circuit.
Right.
So for all his like, yeah, I want to be part of this, he hasn't really put the work in.
Yeah.
Or he's not. Maybe he's tried to put the work in. Mm-hmm. And maybe he's just not talented, you know? But he's not. In many of these shows, you know, you watch Star Trek or something, the people in the Enterprise are the best of the best, right? You watch Luke Skywalker, he's like the best pilot around, and Han Solo is the next best pilot around. Everyone's the best. And Maximus is definitely not the best, you know? He wanted the best squire. He definitely wasn't the best aspirant. He's certainly not the best knight. And so maybe he'll rise to the occasion. But for someone who's like, I've got all these ideals, he's not like the representative of that space. We haven't, you know, with the exception of the clerics, we haven't really seen that. So I thought that was interesting. And now I'm interested in seeing how his character works with that challenge, because at every level, he's just not the best. Like, those guys are beating him up. He's not like, I know this interesting fighting technique and I'm going to take you guys out. No, he's not. Whereas Lucy is the best, right? To juxtapose that. Yes, so she's a believer, just like you said. But she is, you know, what she's like, I'm not very good at like riflery. And she's like hit the target a million times. She's like taken down people with her judo. She's, you know, all this stuff. She's like the best. But he's not the best.
I feel like what Maximus lacks in ability, he has in spirit. He has
in heart.
In heart. In attitude.
E for effort. Yeah.
And maybe for the Brotherhood of Steel, attitude is more important than ability. Who knows?
Well, certainly that is a thing. When they chose him to replace his friend, you know, they seemed impressed by his honesty.
Yeah.
Because he was honest about his feelings. He's like, I was jealous of her. Right. And it might even come out that he put the razor in her boot. Right. It might come out that he did that. That would be a big sea change in terms of how we view him. But what did come out was that he was honest about his feelings about her, which made them believe him.
Yes.
He came across as human. He wasn't going to sit there and be like, I don't know. I've always wanted the best for her. Like, you know, they're all hungry to be out there with those knights. And he's like, you know, I'm sorry this happened, but, you know, I'm ready to go. So anyway, I just thought that was. It's interesting that these two characters are representatives of their respective sort of like zealot groups.
For sure.
But yeah. And I totally agree about the world changing people and like how this idealism stacks up in this wild, wild world.
I thought it was clever that the Vault Tech poster Lucy read in episode one, which said, don't lose your head. By the end of episode two, it takes on a new meaning, like quite literally.
Yeah, and she, you know, she's really gotta hold on to that head.
Yes.
You know, for me, one of the big pictures, like, you know, we've talked about the innocence, we've talked a lot about those pieces, but one of the things was the proletariat versus the bourgeoisie that we see. You know, in the first episode, we see this rich family that's able to afford Cooper to do their work, and at the very end when the shit hits the fan, they're able to have a bunker in their place where they reject anyone who's not their family from entering, right? And really, this is a lot of this show is about this like status of class, be it from like the knights to the vault people and folks who kind of, you know, potentially like rich people feeling that they are better or potentially more entitled than others. Mm-hmm. Even Ma in that shop says, fuck the vaults, right? This is where rich people are able to go away from everyday problems where, you know, folks who don't have enough water to drink, right?
Right.
And it's really interesting to see this ongoing theme of the dissatisfied populace in that we're seeing on a lot of works of fiction these days, as well as we see it in everyday to day life. But in
The haves versus the have nots, right?
Yeah, it's a tale as old as time, right?
Right. This situation where these, you know, Wilson is like, they're all indifferent to your ideals or whatever, it's partly because she can afford to have ideals, you know?
Right.
When you've got your, you know, your belly is full every night, even if it's the same food, you know, and everyone's got their struggles. In the vault, people are, you know, they're people who probably want to be overseer. They're people who aren't doing as well as Lucy, right? That kind of thing. But when your belly is full of food, you can be in the gymnastics. Like every activity she did in the vault was an enriching activity. And the people who live outside are just scraping by. And when you have people who are scraping by, they're desperate for anything, and they're usually both awed and disgusted with those who have been, you know, basically hoarding wealth, which you know, you can look at the it's a vault. They live in a vault. A vault is a place you hoard wealth, right? So
right.
The on the other hand, though, if you want to end this interregnum of a healthy civilization, you did have to concentrate your resources into a place like the vault.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently at least 33 of these vaults, and we don't know how many survived. And granted, the people who were probably in these vaults were people who were, you know, possibly even, or for on average, even wealthier than the dude who had his own bunker. Right.
Right.
Cause how long is a bunker going to last? The vault was like literally a self-sustaining engineered, like underground masterpiece. On some level, maybe the Vault Tech guys had, you know, what's it called? Like, not auditions, but like they went out and they found like enough genetic diversity and all the stuff they needed to support people. But it's just unclear. But at the end of the day, the vault people are the haves and the people outside are the have nots. And when you go into a tough neighborhood after coming out of your fancy suburb, mm-hmm. you're gonna get in trouble. And that's mm-hmm. kind of what's happening.
Another thing I wanted to bring up is that Dr. Wilsig seems to know quite a bit about the vaults. He seems to me to come from a place that was associated with Vault Tech operations. He, at the end of the episode, he takes this Vault Tech cyanide, and I get the implication from it that he developed it for Vault Tech, because he says, I was surprised that it wasn't so popular.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that he developed it, because that would imply that he, like the ghoul, was 200 years old, and it seems like the only people who can make it that long are, you know, people who are, you know, they pull the ghoul out of the ground with like green juice and stuff. You know, it's a very strange thing to be able to live for 200 plus years. I do think that the group he was in, and we don't get the name of it, which is unfortunate, was a group that, you know, they're, whereas the Brotherhood of Steel is technological on some level with some ancient tech that they're just keeping working, and they're kind of religious, his group seemed to be scientific and possibly like providing, you know, resources to the wider world, but pretty strict, right? And so I feel like he was familiar with all the Vault Tech stuff, and he was developing stuff, and he was developing stuff in his time. But he looks at the various like things, and he's looking at Plan D, and you have to wonder how come more people didn't take it. I mean, she found a family that took it.
Yeah.
You know, life is so hard. And if you're him, you're like, life is so hard outside of my scientific community. If you're Maximus, life is so hard outside of the Brotherhood of Steel, right?
Right.
All that stuff. So why wouldn't more people do this? But I think for me, the big picture takeaway there is that humanity is not interested in going quietly into the night. They're going to struggle, but they're going to survive. Surviving and struggling, you know, doing whatever you can for however as long as you can, and maybe even, you know, have, obviously, like, people are having kids, which is why there's so many people left in the world. This is how most people prefer to be rather than just end it, right? And I think there's a point at which if you live in a society like the one we live in today, mm-hmm. and it completely falls apart, the civilization falls apart, and you're like living hand to mouth, you know, you might be like, I can't do this. I can't, like, you know, go hunting irradiated animals to eat or something. And you could say, I want to end it. But if you're born into that world, you're less likely to be like, I have to kill myself. If you're born into that world, you're like, I got to figure out how to make it work.
This is just life.
So if you're like a guy working in the pristine scientific, although rigid community he's in, you know, of course you'd be like, in my mind at least, of course you'd be like, how come more people just don't kill themselves? But I think the people like Ma Janey or whoever owned that shop were like, you know, I'm making it work. Or yeah, so I'm just like, I'm all those people in that Philly place, they're all just traitors and stuff, right? Like, she's walking through Philly and the vendors are trying to sell her lizard meat or whatever. Like, they're all trying to scrape by. And I think that's humanity.
Yep. They're the 99%. I just wanted to point out that I think that the group that Wilsig was with, that's the Enclave, right? Because they mentioned that a target and his companion escaped from the Enclave.
Right. That's true. It is the Enclave. It is the Enclave. We got to figure out what their motivation what is. Insofar as the show. You know, the game will have its own motivation, but the show, it'll do its own thing.
All right. Let's talk about some of the technical aspects. This is where we talk about some of the behind-the-scenes elements we enjoyed in this episode, music, acting, visual effects, etc. And speaking of visual effects, yes, what I wanted to bring up is that in looking at some of these sets, like Philly, where they built a whole little like town center.
It's like watching Waterworld.
Yeah, yeah. I was really delighted to see, like, and then seeing also Vault 33. It's really refreshing to me to see these fully built sets and locations, as opposed to in the trend has been in the last few years, actors working against the volume, which is basically like LED projected backgrounds that are filmed. And, you know, when the volume first came out, it all looked beautiful and realistic and like light years
better than
green screen. But like after a while, now my eye becomes inured to it. And I'm like, I kind of just want like real, tangible, tactile things. I want sets. I want locations.
This is kind of a you problem because you go and you chase out all this behind the scenes stuff.
It's true.
And then you know it. And then you're like, oh, I'm tired of it.
But man, can't
if you're someone, like me, I'm like,
No. I'm going to push back against that because if you've seen really like,
the only reason I know the volume exists is because you sent it to me.
I
would not know it exists.
If you've seen like the latest, season of Star Trek Discovery, you'll see like, all they do is on the volume, and you compare
season 5
that.
Or season 4.
I'm talking about this current season.
I haven't seen it yet. But now my eyes are going to be like, am I looking?
Yeah,
at the volume?
The Mandalorian is all shot on the volume,
right? And I have no idea. I had no idea it was shot on the volume. I haven't been able to just
go back and rewatch some of that stuff.
I don't want to ruin the stuff.
It'll give you.
I'm not interested in that. I want to see the story. I don't want to know how they do it.
You don't want to see how the sausage is made.
I don't need to see how sausage. I do enjoy the tactility of the vault.
Right.
I don't know what they repurposed or what they had to do. I think it's a little silly that they have like, you know, 5 stalks of grain and that's going to save them. But I do think it feels real. I loved the infrastructure aspect of it, especially when she escapes and they've got that bridge and it kind of moves.
Yeah.
And I thought that was all very good. It reminded me of I don't know, just like it felt like I was in the game. The sound was good.
It just felt real is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it was real. And the fact that they built this like Waterworld atoll level set for Philly, I hope they use that again. And also they said a lot of things in the woods. They were like, well, we'll just put some carts in the woods and that's part of it. I'm like, there you go.
Yeah.
You know,
but it's real woods. It's real forest.
I hope so. You know, instead of like a whole bunch of plastic in a studio, but, yeah, and when you're in a studio, you get to choose. The light gets better, all that stuff. So I think there's definitely something to it. And I think also the fact that like there's kind of like this 60s motif, like 50s and 60s motif about the whole thing,
for sure.
That that adds to the need for tactility because that was a time and place where you know everything was done with circuits instead of chips. You know, like everything's kind of like a little bit more hands on. So I do enjoy it.
And the other thing I wanted to mention is that it feels to me like Maximus's first trial in the armor when he's putting it on and like crushing old structures with it. It feels to me totally like a ripoff of like when Peter Parker first tries out his Spidey powers in like version of Spider-Man that you've ever seen. It's that first day with the superpowers trope.
Right, which is a reminder that you know Maximus's skills are not great, but that's because he just got them. And if he's allowed to continue with them, we'll see how good he gets, if at all.
All right, and I have just one bit of ephemera, which is Link's extratextual connections that help you enhance this enjoyment of the episode. I just have an article. Speaking of locations, an article that points out that the wasteland looks so good. In part because it's real. Some of that was shot in the same desert as they shot Mad Max Fury Road. So it's actual. I think it was.
Where is that?
Namibia, I think it was. So, yeah. So, there's a desert in Southern California. Some was shot in a mining town called Kolmenskop, and some on an abandoned diamond refinery on the coast of Namibia.
Gotcha, so, yeah.
So actual, like, desert locations. And that's why that looks so good and so real. All right, that is going to do it for this episode of Vault 33. I'm going to go around the table here and ask, where can people find your work on the internet when you're not talking about Fallout on Amazon Prime? Dwayne, how about you?
You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD, or Instagram. I'm also Dwayne D over there. Check me out.
Towson?
You can find me at Instagram at burnttoast45. So soon there'll be more photos, but I'm waiting for a new camera.
Oh.
Wait and see on that.
Any idea of what camera you're going to get?
Well, assuming I can get my hands on it. Have you heard about the Fuji
V6? Everyone's talking about that camera.
Yeah, it's nice. It's pretty good. What about yourself, Andy? Where can we find you?
My X/Twitter handle is Mr. Baby Man. You can find me there. And our Twitter handle for the show is Fallout Vault 33. We're on all the major podcast distribution networks. Add us, tell your friends. And join us next time when we cover the third episode of Fallout called The Head. Until then, please tweet us, leave us a comment on iTunes, and we'll see you guys soon.
Thanks, guys.
Why don't you crawl up to the Fallout back to me?